From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack alongside Evan Dawson for this week's wrap-up of Connections. Thanks, as always, for joining us. We'll start this week's podcast with the remarkable story of one man's recovery from an addiction to opioids. We devoted both hours on Tuesday to a special program on the opioid crisis. 220 people died of overdoses in Monroe County last year alone. But there are stories of recovery, too. And the one you're about to hear is that of Brandon Scott. He joined us to discuss how he nearly died several times and is now living a healthy life in recovery.
I fell in with the wrong group of people, and they started to drink after high school, and that's how the beginning of my addiction issues started.
Did you drink hard right away?
We partied on the weekends, you know, we drank, and then in the weekdays we went back to our normal lives, but that only lasts for so long.
Was there a time soon thereafter that you thought you were out of control, or did you always think you had control of it?
It got out of control pretty quick, and I was well aware of that. When I started college the next semester, and I realized that school, work, and addiction issues don't really mesh very well, and I wanted to actually start to drink full time, so I dropped out of college.
Did you have people in your life telling you this is a problem?
Nobody in my life at this point really knew the extent of which I was doing it. I was hiding it pretty well at this point.
Okay, but what happened last year that put you in the Monroe County Jail wasn't necessarily related to alcohol, right? So when did you end up doing, because I think your story takes you to heroin.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get there?
It started with the drinking because mm-hmm. I was driving a vehicle and I was so drunk that I was being really stupid, and I decided to see how fast my car can go. Long story short, I hit a tree going 95 miles an hour. I woke up in the hospital and handcuffed to the bed, but after I got released, they gave me a prescription for opiate painkillers. And addiction didn't take over right then. It's very gradual at this point because I started taking those pills, and then I realized that, you know, you take more of them and you start to feel a little better. So I started to take more and more, and then they have less of an effect the more you take. So I had to keep getting stronger substances, and eventually it led me to heroin when I actually went to a detox center at this point, and everybody in the detox center told me I needed to try heroin if I was doing all these pills. So by the time I left detox,
Everyone was telling you that, you mean other patients?
Patients in the detox center,
so
yes.
So patients were telling you, you need heroin,
mm-hmm.
and you went out and found it.
When I left the detox center, I had every intent of staying clean until I crossed the threshold of those doors. And the first thought through my mind was, I need to try this if all the patients are recommending it. Wow. And that's just the way my mind thought at that point.
Wow. When was that, by the way? What year was that?
That was probably 8 or 9 years ago,
okay,
I'd say.
All right. And so it's been a while then.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you find in terms of your own either ability to handle heroin or your desire for it? Did you use regularly from that point on?
From the first time I used heroin, it was a regular thing, yes.
Yeah.
And it steals your soul, honestly. It gets to a point where it becomes automatic and it takes over all of the priorities in my life, because when you don't have it, you get so sick, and the physical withdrawals from heroin are so intense that I'd be willing to do anything to make that go away. And so right then and there, all my morals go out the window, and heroin becomes the only thing I'm thinking about.
Did you have moments over the ensuing 8 or 9 years where you really did want to get yourself freed of it?
Almost every night I would tell myself, this is enough. I mean, I'm gonna die if I keep on this way. But then every single morning, as soon as I would open my eyes and I would feel that pain from the withdrawal set in, my mind would just go straight back to how am I gonna get my next fix.
All right, so you end up last year in a situation where Brandon and I were talking before the program began, because the before and after picture that maybe you're looking at on our various social media feeds, Brandon really looks like a different person. But it was early in last year that you had a moment where you thought, you know, you need to tell your family you may be gone soon. What was going on early in 2017?
I was admitted to Strong Hospital. I don't remember. Well, the last thing I remember was being taken out of the apartment I was in on a stretcher. And then I woke up in the ICU about a week later. I was told that I had been in a coma the whole time. I had a blood infection which traveled to all over my body. It gave me an infection in my heart and in my brain, and I spent a total of 77 days in the hospital, and I came so close to dying that when I was first admitted, they told my mother to prepare herself for the fact that I'm probably not going to make it back out of the hospital.
did you have conversations with your mother? Did she fully understand what was going on then?
I believe she did. I don't know. Like, there's been certain times where I think that I hid it well enough from her, but then there's other times I think she had to have known.
Can I ask, how do you view your relationship with your family?
Today, I mean, my relationship with my mother is very good today.
Good.
I try to leave most of my family alone for the most part, considering I've been, you know, a thorn in their side for so long now. I try to give them space at this point. But I can always reach out and talk to them, and they're very proud of me today. So.
Wow, that's tremendous self-awareness. But the work that you're doing, we're going to talk in a minute about dealing hope and some of the work that you're doing as part of recovery. So I imagine they are very proud of you because you go throughout last year. Your family's warned that they may need to be prepared for the fact that you're going to be gone. You survived that 77-day stay, but you end up back in front of a judge on September 26th, and he puts you in jail, and you have written that that was the best thing that happened for you. So take me through that.
I was part of drug court, and I only took drug court because I wanted the freedom to be able to continue to use, but I didn't realize that I'd end up in jail pretty quick. So I get sent to Monroe County Jail on September 26th, and at this point, my state of mind is telling me just to comply with whatever they need me to do, whatever they want me to do, so I can get back out of jail, so I can continue using, because at this point, I think it's the only option in my life. And so I'm in Monroe County Jail for about 5 weeks, and, you know, I had to detox in jail, and detoxing in jail is probably the worst possible way to detox.
Why do you say that?
Because it's cold turkey. They don't give you anything. I mean, in a detox center or an inpatient, they'll give you, you know, certain substances to help you come down easier. Not in jail. They make you sweat it out.
Wow.
And that was the only time I've ever had to detox like that through the whole thing.
I'm kind of curious to know if that worked for you or if that...
I believe it did.
You did.
Yeah. I mean, going through that amount of pain, like every time I get a thought or a craving about using drugs again, I just think back to what I went through in that jail cell. It was not fun.
But eventually you're coming out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you think it was different this time? Because of the cold turkey? Because did that prepare you in some kind of way?
Yeah, it did. Like I said, just remembering the pain. And then they sent me directly to an inpatient after I got out of jail. So I still wasn't able to hit the streets yet. And that was probably the best thing for me, because at that point, I would have went back to using if I was free to do so. When I got to the inpatient, though, was when I actually started to work towards my recovery, when I started to see other people that were happy in sobriety, and I decided that was something I wanted.
Boy, that sounds, at least from my observation of your story, it sounds like that's really key, because in a previous episode, you're hearing other patients telling you, you got to get on heroin. And now this time around, you're seeing people who are in recovery and they're happy to be in recovery.
Yeah.
And to you, was that like the first light that says, wait, that could be me. I could do that.
Yeah, well, that was something that was absurd to me at a certain point. Like, I never believed that you could actually be sober and be happy. Like, those two words didn't belong in the same sentence, as far as I thought for a long time. But the more I talked to these people that brought certain meetings into the facility, I could tell that they were actually genuine, and they really were sober, and they really were happy. And I began to envy them, and I stopped thinking I knew everything, and I started to realize I knew nothing, so I was open to being guided.
What did you need to learn most?
How to stay occupied and not want to use drugs and alcohol, because... as long as I can remember, I've always needed, you know, social lubricants to have fun. So activities with sober people and sober environments was definitely a very big key in my recovery.
How did you find these guys? How did you find Rockcovery?
Rockcovery Fitness came into the facility. I was in an inpatient, and I actually didn't get to attend the meeting. I think I was asleep and nobody woke me up. But all the patients were coming back from the meeting, and they were talking about it like for hours. And I was like, I got to check this place out when I leave. And that's exactly what I did.
Now, were you somebody growing up? Did you work out much growing up?
No. I was the exact opposite, actually. I was a bookworm. I was a computer guy. I majored in IT. Like, it's a complete 180.
I mean, because meeting you now, people who meet you probably assume you played cornerback on the football team, you ran track, you know.
No.
You lifted. So that was new to you.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how much you weighed in those before and how much you weigh now?
About 175.
like no body fat.
Right. Well, I'm sure there's some.
175, and you probably in September 26, 2017, you probably weighed a lot less. Do you know what you weighed?
I believe it was around 115.
115 pounds.
And so I'm 5'8", so.
5'8", 115.
Yep.
60 pounds different, a totally different look to you. What do people who grew up with you, when they haven't seen you in years, when they bump into you now, what do they say?
Oh, I actually haven't run into many people that I grew up with.
Oh, you got to have to do that.
Everybody that's in my life today, I've actually met in the program.
You got right into Rockcovery, and was it hard? I mean, having not lifted weights and kind of been in that?
No, it was actually incredibly easy. The first time I ever walked through the doors of Rockcovery Fitness, everybody there greeted me like I was already like part of the family, like I was accepted, and that was completely new to me.
Next, the Brett Kavanaugh investigation produced a debate about whether it's normal and natural for men to get into physical altercations, namely bar fights. Our panel discussed male violence and acceptable standards of behavior. In this clip, you'll hear a caller named Brenna, who shared a story about what her son did when he was punched at school.
Just wanted to share something that happened to my son, who's 18, even just a couple months ago. We have two sons. My husband and I raised them, so, you know, with acknowledging their, you know, physical power and strength, but we wanted to channel that. So, you know, we taught them that, you know, they could not hit people, you know, out of anger or anything like that. The only reason that they could hit somebody is if they were protecting themselves and, like, couldn't get out of the situation in any other possible way. So my husband taught them how to throw a punch properly, you know. And so for years he would, you know, practice with them and show them how to, you know, their form and technique, and so that they could really, you know, stop this, you know, their attacker or whatever, if they needed to, with a punch. And it never had to be used before until a few months ago. He was in school, they were in gym class, and, you know, the boys were playing basketball, and it was rather aggressive. It was just getting a little heated, and there was a ball stolen, and one of his classmates turned around and punched my son in the face. Like, just, it was very unexpected, and my son kind of stood there shocked, and the kid hit him again. At that point, you know, the gym teacher saw what happened, came over, you know, my son was able to block the third punch and everything, but I, you know, he didn't hit back. And so I asked him, I was like, okay, if you felt cornered and you felt like you couldn't get out of that situation, you could have hit him back. He's like, but Mom, I could have really hurt him. He's like, I felt like I shouldn't have done that. So he's like, I knew I could have, but I didn't want to. So I was so proud of him that, you know, he saw it for what it was. He felt like, okay, well, I can take the punch. And he felt like it would have done more damage to hit back than to just, you know, let the situation diffuse on its own.
Is how old? 18?
He's 18.
Oh, so, smart kid.
Yeah, he's got it going on.
You know, we were so relieved that, you know, he's made the right decision in that moment, even though he could have made the other decision and been justified in that. And we even talked with the other classmate and his parents afterwards, and they were mortified that this even happened and very apologetic. And we just, you know, we said to him, it's like, if you had hit a different kid or somebody else, it's like, they may have hit you back, yeah, and you could have been hurt.
Yeah.
Like, you were lucky that you hit, you know, you hit my son. So it was a teaching moment for that boy as well.
Brenna, thank you. That's remarkable. I want to turn to Ken Stoneberg from the Mankind Project, because you've been talking about this emotional maturity. This 18-year-old man.
Oh, this guy's got it going on. I'd love to meet this guy and invite him to one of our circles in town here. He sounds amazing, and he sounds like a real potential mentor for other kids.
I mean, that is a tough moment to be in, where you're literally taking a punch to the face.
Yeah, but, and then not reacting.
And having the emotional control to say, I could punch back.
Right.
I could really deck this kid. I don't know.
He kept his presence. He kept his mind. That was amazing.
Kit, do you agree with Brenna's contention that in that moment, her son would have been justified in swinging back?
I don't know about that. I actually think that what his choice to not swing back presented so much more power and inspiration in this room.
And I'm not being critical of Brenna. No, observing. I mean, I understand exactly the point she's making.
Yeah, I think if he had swung back, it would have been what people do. And what I'm impressed by is he had enough, not just the presence of mind, but he was strong. He didn't experience being attacked as making him look weak. There was enough strength in him that he was able to stay himself even in that moment. And so I applaud Brenna and her husband that have given their son this such a sense of himself, so much strength in himself, that he didn't feel that being hit twice and not responding would look weak to other people. So that's cool. And that, for me, is actually nonviolence in action right there, the ability to take it. And then look what's happening. We're telling the story on the air right now. We wouldn't be probably doing this and talking about it even if he'd done what the habit energy would have been, which was to just hit back. It would have been another fight in a gym class, one of probably thousands that takes place. So doing that other thing, which takes a tremendous amount of presence and strength, is, you know, I celebrate that.
Finally this week, a gripping conversation about how to heal some of the divisions in this country. Many Americans now view anyone with differing political views as the enemy. Well, this week we sat down with Meg Handler, a longtime documentary photographer who has put together a remarkable exhibit called Whose Streets, Our Streets. It's a collection of photojournalism from New York City's social protest scene dating back to 1980. Those protests covered a range of subjects: racism, police brutality, war, AIDS, the environment, and more. RIT is hosting this exhibit until November 9th. Now, Meg Handler views herself as an ally to these social causes, but she also feels it's vital to understand Americans with the opposite views. So in this clip, she's talking about the work she did in photographing anti-abortion demonstrations. Handler supports legal abortion, and she thought the tactics of the anti-abortion movement were rather monstrous. But she says she also knows these folks are sincere and worthy of respect and understanding. Let's listen.
One of the great challenges in being the kind of documentary photographer I am and Joseph is and many of our peers is to not look at people in that way. And it doesn't mean don't look at them critically, but it means, as Josh said, look at them with empathy. Try and understand. You can't stand in their shoes, but you can try and understand where they're coming from. And if somebody is a fundamentalist and believes very specific things, then I, as a documentarian, have to respect that and understand it. Doesn't mean I agree with it. Now, I navigated those waters by literally making eye contact with people and listening to them. I didn't argue with anybody. I didn't get into, you know, political conversations with people. I kept it very neutral, which is, you know, maybe particularly manipulative or whatever, but that was kind of my way of having an exchange. But you can look into somebody's eyes and let them know you understand them. And all of their defense mechanisms are going to come down and they're going to, I don't know. It's just it's kind of this exchange that happens between photographer and subject, and it's a shared moment. But those things don't just happen. You both have to give something. I always really wanted to see the humanity in people, first off, and then I also wanted to look at the theatricality of these demonstrations. There was a lot of street theater involved, and it wasn't just coming from the left. The right used theatrics too. You know, the people from the pro-life movement holding up these really horrible posters that nobody really wanted to look at, and that was the point. And so how do you make a picture of those people holding those signs without focusing on the horror of the sign? And I think that was my challenge as somebody who was documenting that movement. How do I not show this as monstrous as it looks? And I found a way to do it, but it had to do with, like, what Joe said, you have to spend time with these groups. You have to kind of be a presence without the camera being up to your eye so that you can be that fly on the wall.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, on WRUR 88.5 FM, and on WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM. We're on the WXXI, that's the word, the WXXI mobile app as well, so you can listen wherever you are and tell your friends in other states, in other countries. You can always find us. For Megan Mack, I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful weekend. We're back with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.